From good afternoon, or good morning, brethren, yesterday to good afternoon today, we're back to that routine, which is not too bad. Let's get the elephant in the room out of the way. I am wearing a brace on my right arm. I woke up the other day, a couple days ago, with a gout flare-up. I didn't realize until last night that it was gout in my wrist. I get it in my foot, my right foot, and sometimes my left foot, mostly in my right foot. I don't know what it has about the right side of my body, but gout loves me on this side of my body. But I was suspicious about something because I think my body is doing something here because I think it knows that my left hand's pretty lazy and it gets away with not doing a whole lot, right? My right hand's doing everything. My left hand doesn't hardly do anything. Now, all of a sudden, I have to do everything with my left hand. And let me tell you something. It is not easy. You southpaws, you've been doing it since you were babies, okay? This is something we who don't have that experience. It's tough. This is a right-handed world for me. So anyway, just wanted to share that with you. But speaking of bodies, Mr. Dick yesterday, nice segue, huh? Mr. Dick yesterday was talking about us as a collective body. And obviously that was the last day of unleavened bread, and he's wrapping us up and moving us on in that message towards where we're going spiritually from there. But certainly God has placed us in his church. We collectively form this body. We called out ones. That's the definition of the word church. And he stressed that we are to become one. That was the point of his message, at least in part. And I want to begin today with the scripture that he launched with yesterday. I want to go a slightly different direction. Over in 1 Corinthians chapter 12. 1 Corinthians chapter 12 and verse 12. Again, this is a scripture that we know very well, so you don't need to turn there if you don't want to. I'll just read it for us. It says, "For as the body is one and has many members, but all the members of that one body, being many, are one body, so also is Christ." We are to become one body. But again, we're a collection of individuals. We're not all the same. We're not yellow pencils, right? We're different from each other. So I'm going to tie in the Women's Enrichment Weekend. So Mr. Slocum and I were invited to speak at the Women's Enrichment Weekend. And in that weekend, the subject was forbearance. So I want to tie these two issues or these two concepts together in today's message and to make that message relevant to this audience on this day. The question I have for you today is, how do we bear with one another? How do we bear with one another? So I'm going to digress just a moment to share something with you. It's an exploration of a question I have for myself with regard to this question of patience. So nobody's ever described me as a patient person, at least not when I was growing up. And I raised three kids, and at least two of them, Becca and I nicknamed patients because of their dramatic lack of it. And so I think they came by it very legitimately from Rebecca. No, from me. There's no question about it. It definitely comes from me. But so I'm asking myself this question, and let me illustrate my problem for you here, and hopefully this will tie in for you. So I hate traveling, and yet I do a lot of traveling. Now, it was when I was younger, like when I was in my mid-20s, I thought traveling was this incredible idea. Getting on an airplane like a professional businessman, flying to some romantic location where I was going to be doing some businessy thing, and then flying home like all the businessmen that you see in the airport are doing. And they all look important. And I thought, fantastic, I want to do that. One day, if I could get there, I want to do that. Now I'm 53. And I've traveled a lot in those past 15 years. And I will just tell you that the bloom is off that rose. If you've done any traveling, especially extensive traveling, you know what I mean. But this year started off with the second week of January traveling. And I traveled every single week through the end of February, skipped a week, traveled again 3 weeks in March. So I barely got a reprieve from traveling. And let me just briefly explain some of the things that can happen to you if you're traveling. So there really should be two airlines out there. That one airline for the experienced traveler and an airline for the not experienced traveler. And there's a reason that I'm going to argue that for you just briefly as a diversion here. And that is because the experienced traveler knows how to travel. They know that it's painful. So they do everything they can to make it less painful for themselves. So they have luggage that matches in it and it cooperates and they fit. Okay? And that's a key, by the way. They fit in the airplane. And most of the time we don't pack, nothing goes down the conveyor belt off to some, be packed in. No. You take everything with you and you bring it onto that airplane so you can take it off with you. So you don't want to wait. You got to go. You got things to do. But the inexperienced traveler is not aware of some of these things. And so they're bringing four bags. You're allowed two, just two. They'll have four, and then they'll stop the whole works so that they can get their four bags packed down into two bags, that neither of which will fit the airplane. So that'll have to be gate checked. And if you're an experienced traveler, you're waiting on all of this. You're wondering. So I usually, what I end up doing is I plug my ears in to music. Because what I don't want to have happen is I don't want to form a new relationship on the airplane. I don't want to learn about their life. I don't want to learn why they're traveling. I don't want to answer questions about what I do. You know why? Because I can't answer that question. People ask all the time, what do you do? If I start down that road, your eyes are going to roll up into the back of your head. It's just boring. And nobody would understand it anyway, unless you're in this niche industry I'm in. And so I just plug my ears in, I listen to music, and I try to just, I stay right here, real tight. And most travelers that are experienced, you see them, they all do the same exact thing. They're laptops, they're focused, they got things to do, they're maximized this time, and don't talk to me. Okay, why am I sharing all that? Because I have to ask myself, am I a patient person? Now, when you're traveling and you're dealing with lots of people that are not experienced at traveling and doing the sorts of things you are experienced at, and they're making it more painful for you, you're asking yourself, well, what am I enduring? How do I endure this process? How do I get through this without hurting myself or someone else in this process? Am I patient? What does that even mean, to be patient? That's the first question I began to ask myself. Am I patient? What is patience? Do I have it? So I looked it up. I really want to know, am I a patient person? And you'll see where how this all ties together. Trust me, I'm going to bring this all along together. So I looked it up on Merriam-Webster's online dictionary, and it says, bearing pains or trials calmly or without complaint. So that's an in-the-moment thing. So, and I'll be honest, I mean, I'm not perfect at that by any stretch of the word, but I'm not guilty of it all the time either. So, in other words, I can be patient. It's not taking action. It's calmly bearing pains or trials. Okay. Well, I've described to you how much I enjoy flying and all of the pains that are associated with a painful flight. And yet I don't erupt at anybody. I don't yell or snap. I help people with their bags. You know how many people don't do that kind of stuff? You know how many people are impatient? I watched a guy. We were flying from, it was just one of these days. And I would say about 30 or 40% of the time, your flight is going to go wrong. I flew from Miami one time, and I thought this was going to be great. I'm going to get in. It's going to be perfect. And we're an hour and a half short of Portland, which means that we're someplace near Salt Lake City. And the pilot gets on and he says, ladies and gentlemen, we have a problem with one of our fuel tanks. We're going to have to land here and have this investigated. Oh my God, we're so close. That's a long flight. It's a long day, made even longer by landing in Salt Lake City for a six-hour layover before you get back on and go home. On another flight coming from Ontario, going all the way down to Dallas-Fort Worth, we missed. It was a delay. Ended up leaving at 5:30. I had an 11:30 a.m. flight out, and it left at 5:30. Nope. Had a little problem with some instrumentation, so 5:30 became 6:30, became 7. So we're leaving Ontario at 7. We got to get to Dallas-Fort Worth, and every one of us has a 10-minute connection window. Almost every single person. So if you know that, you're not the only one on the airplane who's got a tight connection. And yet I watch this guy climb across the guy on the aisle as soon as the plane landed. Virtually, as soon as it hit the gate, he climbed across the guy sitting next to him to get to the aisle so he could grab his bag and then shoved his way in front of people saying, I'm sorry, I've got a late connection. Just like everybody else on the airplane, because we're all late. But that's the way it is when you're flying out there. So people were not patient in that environment. I watched and I wondered, well, am I patient? Well, I didn't say anything to the guy. I kept it all tightly packed under the hood. That doesn't mean you're not frustrated, but it means calmly dealing with it. Okay, I have done that. There are times I haven't, but most of the time I've done that. Another meaning, manifesting forbearance under provocation or strain. Manifesting forbearance under provocation or strain. Patience also means not hasty or impetuous. It also means steadfast despite opposition, difficulty, or adversity. And it also means able or willing to bear. Able or willing to bear. So patience then becomes this thing of how you act in the moment, how you deal with a crisis in the moment, how you deal with adversity in the moment. That's patience. That doesn't mean later, when you're talking to your wife, or you happen to be giving a sermon and you're spilling all your frustrations out, that means that you're impatient. No, it just means you're sharing your frustrations. There's a difference between being impatient and sharing a frustration. If you shared your frustration in the moment, you wouldn't be patient. Fair? That's what patience, that's the distinction between those two. Okay. So let's distinguish between bearing pains or trials calmly or without complaint and an aspect of forbearance. And notice again that one of the aspects of patience is manifesting forbearance under provocation or strain. So what does it mean then to manifest forbearance? It means to display or show a quality or feeling by one's acts or appearance, to demonstrate something. So we're familiar with this idea called bearing with one another, as Paul described it to the church at Ephesus in the book of Ephesians, Ephesians chapter 4, beginning in verse 1, Ephesians 4, beginning in verse 1, where he says, "Therefore the prisoner of the Lord, therefore the prisoner of the Lord, beseech you to walk worthy of the calling with which you were called, with all lowliness and gentleness, with long-suffering, bearing with one another in love, endeavoring to keep the unity of the Spirit in the bond of peace." Why are we told here to bear with one another? What is it that we have to bear? So first we have to ask ourselves, is it talking about sin when we bear with one another? Or are we talking about sin? I think we know the answer automatically has to be no to that. But Paul explains very clearly that the answer is no when he gives us 1 Corinthians chapter 5 and verse 9, when he walks that church through the problem that they were dealing with. 1 Corinthians chapter 5 and verse 9. "I wrote you in my epistle not to keep company with sexually immoral people, yet I certainly did not mean with the sexually immoral people of this world or with the covetous or extortioners or idolaters, since then you would need to go out of the world. But now I have written to you not to keep company with anyone named a brother who is sexually immoral or covetous or an idolater or a reviler or a drunkard or an extortioner, not even to eat with such a person. For what have I to do with judging those also who are outside? Do you not judge those who are inside? But those who are outside God judges. Therefore, quote, put away from yourselves the evil person." In other words, if we were to avoid contact with anyone committing sin in this world, well, it's impossible. We cannot do that. We have no control over what's going on out there, and God says we have to live here, where all the other people are, where all the other sin is. So we can't remove ourselves from that influence. And Paul's not saying that we should, but he is saying that we are not to put up with that in the church. Duh, we know that. But it's a distinction between somebody that's doing something wrong deliberately. We're not talking about somebody that trips up, makes a mistake, commits a sin, immediately goes into repentance mode, turns around, and they're trying to fix that. They're trying to deal with that. We're not talking about that. We're talking about somebody practicing sin. No, that is out. We do not tolerate that in this church. So that's not what we're being told to bear with one another. So manifesting forbearance comes with another word. If you go back to that definition of patience, it said manifesting forbearance. It said under provocation. Under provocation or strain. You know, the simple definition of provoke means to stimulate or incite somebody, someone, to do something or feel something, especially by arousing them in anger or arousing anger in them. You know, if you go back throughout the entire Old Testament and every reference that we find of God and the word provoke, we find God saying things like, "You provoke me to anger. Why do you provoke me?" It's not ever really used in a positive way. Provoke is generally a negative. It creates a negative response when we provoke one another. We can provoke someone intentionally. That's not a good idea, right? At least in this sense, that's not a good idea. Or we can do it unintentionally. Can we unwittingly or unintentionally provoke each other in this church? If we can and do unwittingly and unintentionally provoke each other, how do we get along with one another to become one? That's the question. How do we become one if we're provoking each other? Obviously, that's more difficult if we're provoking each other intentionally. There doesn't seem like that's a road to a healthy relationship. But unintentionally is going to happen. No matter what we do, there's going to be some unintentional provoking going on. How do we deal with that? Again, Paul says, with all lowliness and gentleness, with long suffering, bearing with one another. Bearing with one another. I have a few quotes today from Albert Barnes' notes. I just like the way his brain works for some reason, the way he keeps things simplified. You've got Matthew Henry on one side, who's complicating everything, and you've got Albert Barnes here, who really simplifies very well. He says, here's what it means. Bearing patiently with the foibles, faults, and infirmities of others. The virtue here required is that which is to be manifested in our manner of receiving the provocations with which we meet from our brethren. It's the manner in which we receive those provocations, how we deal with being provoked. I was thinking about some of these things like foibles and faults and infirmities of others. And certainly we are going to have those in the church, are we not? Every single one of us comes packaged with those things. I'm bringing some infirmity with me today. And there's certain things that are probably going to be associated with that infirmity with regard to how I behave, perhaps. If somebody shakes my hand, like Mr. Rogers yesterday, I broke my hand, right? And I'm almost like, oh, he doesn't do that intentionally. That was unintentional. I wasn't really provoked. I just wanted to cry. But you understand what I'm saying. So the provocations Paul obviously is talking about here are weaknesses, personality differences, philosophical differences, differences in likes and dislikes, and so on. Again, at the heart of the question is, how do we learn to get along with each other when there are so many differences between us where there can be unintentional provocations? Again, Paul says we have to learn to bear with one another, which means to patiently endure. Patiently endure. Think about what that would mean, to patiently endure. So I was wondering to myself, and so I've created for you some areas in which we might provoke one another unintentionally in God's church. Are there differences in personalities? Yes, there are. All of us would immediately recognize that there are definitely differences in personalities. So I have to frame this correctly because I don't want to get in trouble. If you've ever heard Gary Smalley talking about this concept of lions, otters, beavers, and golden retrievers, it's not new information, it's old information. And for what it's worth, it's simply an exploration into the question of whether or not there are differences in personalities. Whether or not you want to call somebody a lion, and that a lion has all of these strengths, I'll read you some of the strengths of a lion. It says that they're visionary, practical, productive, strong-willed, independent, decisive leaders. I would say two or three of those would apply to other personality types, at least, right? I mean, a beaver is one of the most productive types of people out there. So we can't say that any one of these things is going to be exclusive. And we certainly recognize that strengths are areas where we can appreciate each other. I appreciate the strengths that people have. I think we're all that way. Otter, a strength of an otter. I'm only using his terms, okay? But you guys understand, I'm more concerned with the strengths that are being brought out here. Outgoing, responsive, warm, friendly, talkative, enthusiastic, compassionate. Who wouldn't love those strengths in somebody? Who wouldn't want to be around somebody like that, right? They sound fun. Sounds like you would enjoy that. What about somebody that's calm, easygoing, dependable, quiet, objective, diplomatic, humorous? Again, an individual that would exemplify any of those strengths would be somebody that you would be probably want to talk with, maybe counsel with somebody that has a kind of personality that's like that, might be a little bit more merciful, a little bit more forgiving, a little easier going. How about somebody that's analytical, self-disciplined, industrious, organized, aesthetic, sacrificing? I absolutely love that person, especially if they were willing to sacrifice for what I want them to do, right? My wife has a lot of that feature. I love that about her. So she can work with me in my business and help me, and I thoroughly enjoy that. I need somebody that has those strengths because there's a few of those that I would have to say maybe not so much for me, right? I mean, all of us probably realize that we don't have all of those strengths. We would like to have all those strengths, I'm sure. I would love every one of those strengths. I don't have them mastered right now. But those strengths make it easy for us to get along. What about the weaknesses? What about the weaknesses? This is what Albert Barnes was saying we have to be aware of. Weaknesses. How about weaknesses such as cold, domineering, unemotional, self-sufficient, unforgiving, sarcastic, cruel? The exact person when you're having a real problem you want to sit down and talk to about it. Right? That's the person I need to speak with right there. What about the person that is undisciplined, unproductive, exaggerates? Isn't that every fisherman out there? Egocentric. I don't know, Mr. Sexton. Is that off? Egocentric, unstable. Again, we can recognize weaknesses and say, I'd have a hard time with some of that. How about somebody that suffers from selfishness, is stingy, or a procrastinator, unmotivated? So I have a lot of schedules in my life, and so the procrastinator is a tough one for me because I got to get things done. So if somebody's procrastinating on their end of something, that becomes my problem. That really grates on me. Unmotivated, indecisive, fearful, a worrier. Okay, again, we can see some of these characteristics in all of us can see some of these characteristics in anybody that we looked at. One or more of any one of the ones I've described so far. How about moody? We all love a moody person. Self-centered. Touchy. Yeah, the eggshell effect, right? Can't walk around without cracking some eggshells. Everybody loves that. Touchy. Negative. Unsociable. Critical. Revengeful. Look, we can probably all show some of these things, too. I guarantee you, when I get on an airplane, the way that I am, I bet you people think I'm unsociable. And I'd probably be willing to say that's probably pretty correct at that point. I'm not really feeling sociable. I'm feeling unsociable. So I'm mentioning these differences in our personalities for a very simple reason, of course. Personality differences can be areas where we can provoke each other. Okay? If I'm working with somebody and they're demonstrating certain weaknesses in their personality that don't really work for me very well, they're provoking me. They're not doing it deliberately. How can you possibly do something that is inherent to your personality deliberately? You'd have to concentrate on that somehow, and I don't think we're capable of being that good. So we have to think about weaknesses in other people. We are going to have them in God's church. We're not stuck on those weaknesses. Not one of us says, I have this weakness, but I'm not willing to change it. Or we're not really down the path of conversion. So we know we're working on it. We know that's what we're supposed to be doing, changing and fixing those weaknesses. But a lot of times, we're just not aware that that's a part of who we are. Our personalities are so very different from each other. And in those differences, we can and do unwittingly provoke one another. Can we learn to bear with one another's personalities? This next one is a particular favorite of mine because it happens in my world a lot. I called it opinions vary, because everybody's got an opinion. Everybody has an opinion. You know what an opinion really is? It's very simple. It's just a judgment or opinion or a belief we come to. Isn't it funny how often the younger you see people, the more that they can be very opinionated too? Young people can be very opinionated. How much life do you have in you that you have an opinion on this already? Right? But it happens. My kids did it all the time, and I'm like, you can't even have an opinion until you're 40. You have to experience something first, right? Shouldn't you have to? There is a difference between fact and opinion. We know that, but I'm going to explain a little farther anyway. Fact. A fact is something that can be shown to be true, to exist, or to have happened. So you can prove a fact. An opinion is a belief, judgment, or way of thinking about something. So we all form beliefs and judgments and opinions about things because of the way we think about things. But opinions are differentiated in this way. Now, this is important for us to remember because sometimes we're guilty of doing it incorrectly. Opinions can either be substantiated or unsubstantiated. So where it might grate on somebody like me is if you have an unsubstantiated opinion, strongly held and expressed, and I happen to know the facts that would contradict that opinion. Now, if you're like that, how do you feel about the person who's expressing said opinion, which is clearly wrong? Who likes that? Who enjoys that? What does that lead to normally? Disagreement. Right? It leads to disagreement. If you can check a fact, example, statistic, or expert opinion, you have a valid, substantiated opinion. So what it means to have a substantiated opinion is to literally have an opinion that's backed up by facts. So you might make a statement. I was trying to figure out a good example of this, and I was really struggling. I was thinking of something goofy. And the first thing that popped into my head is, I hate Brussels sprouts. Everybody must hate Brussels sprouts. So is that a substantiated or unsubstantiated opinion? Some of you are saying that's completely unsubstantiated. However, I did some checking. And as it turns out, throughout the world, in every major poll that's ever been done, Brussels sprouts reaches the top 5 in most hated vegetables. Not joking. So I feel substantiated in my opinion that Brussels sprouts are awful. You may still disagree with that. Hopefully we don't have a major disagreement about something so obvious. Okay, so obviously an unsubstantiated opinion is one in which you can't prove it. So I don't have a good example of that. There's too many of them to go around for me to think of one off the top of my head. But here's some topics that go around the world that I've heard even amongst the halls of our church in which we can have varying substantiated and unsubstantiated opinions that don't necessarily lead to harmony within our church. Certainly they can lead to provocations, though I think they're unintentional. I am not going to express an opinion on any of these. I'm just going to cite some of the hot topics that people are struggling with their varying opinions. Don't throw anything either, because the first one is vaccines. Healthcare, spanking, Sabbath dress, global warming, minimum wage, social media, video games, movies, TV shows, books, homeschooling. The list goes on and on and on of areas where, even in God's church, we can have conflicting opinions, some substantiated, some unsubstantiated, and really, it's just opinions. They're just opinions, and we need to be mindful of that. In fact, when it comes to the Bible, Paul was very critical on this issue. Over in Romans chapter 14, you'll recall that this chapter really boils down to a conflict within the church or within the area over vegetarianism versus eating meat versus fasting. Really, that's at the heart of all of this. But you know what Paul says here in verse 1 of chapter 14? As for the one who is weak in faith, welcome him, but not to quarrel over opinions. So Paul is saying right away, look, you have an opinion, I get that, but if your opinion is more important to you than the salvation of your brother or sister, keep it to yourself. But that's really what we have to be thinking about when it comes to opinions. We can provoke each other without even intending to with our opinions. One person believes he may eat anything, while the weak person eats only vegetables. Let not the one who eats despise the one who abstains. And let not the one who abstains pass judgment on the one who eats, for God has welcomed him. In life, each of us forms opinions or judgments that are sometimes substantiated and sometimes not substantiated. We can and do have different opinions that can provoke one another. Can we patiently endure each other's opinions? Okay, the third one that I want to mention today. These are just, I've just had three basic ones that I wanted to go through, is miscommunication. Because again, these are all three of these things have something in common, and that is that it's easy for them to unintentionally happen. And since we're talking about brothers and sisters in Christ, we're talking about becoming one, hopefully none of us are intentionally doing some of these things that would cause, you know, disharmony within the body. Yet miscommunication happens, and it's very easy for it to happen. You know, there's a game that we used to play. And I know as soon as I say there's a game, you're probably all thinking of the same game. The game is called telephone. We played it when we were teenagers in the church at YOU, and we would sit around, there'd be a group of 15 or 20 of us kids, and then somebody would start, and the way the game is played is very simple. Somebody starts with a statement, a phrase, and you don't want it to be like, the dog ate his food. It has to be somewhat more complex, because the more complex the statement is, the harder it is for it to make that circle. And that's the whole point of the game. Can you say your statement in such a clear way and then have that reach all the way around and it sounds the same when it comes back to you? And the answer is it's impossible. It is literally impossible. You will start, and what you might have been talking about could have been anything in the world. I can't think of anything off the top of my head. But whatever you start with, what comes all the way back around that chain, you will not have thought that it had ever been, how could we have been that far from what I started with? That's what it ends up being. And miscommunication can often be something like that. You say something, it's understood some other way. Why is that? How is it that we communicate in which we can have this difficulty? Dr. Albert Mehrabian, author of Silent Messages, conducted several studies on nonverbal communication. He found that 7% of any message is conveyed through words, 38% through certain vocal elements, and 55% through nonverbal elements, meaning facial expressions, gestures, posture, etc. So what do we naturally want to do when we want to communicate something? Send an email or a text. So we can communicate effectively 7% of our message with somebody else and hope that they get it exactly the way we intend it. So I made two colossal errors in my life when it came to communicating that I will never forget, because I communicated these things in writing. That's just not a good idea. So the first was I was very frustrated with a job that I had. And so thankfully this was many years ago. You would have thought that I would have learned it. I did in that sense, not in another sense. So on my way out, I wrote my boss that dreaded, I don't want to work here anymore, I quit letter that had a lot of things to say in it. Lots and lots of negative things. Lots of angry things. Lots of frustrated things. I documented it all out for him. I wanted him to know why I was quitting. And I didn't want there to be any mistake in the communication. And there wasn't a mistake in the communication. He fully understood it, so you're gone. That wasn't the problem. It was, why would you burn a bridge like that? I mean, if it came back to me because years later when I was in need of a job, And I went to this individual. I had to repair the damage that I had done by writing all those things and actually sending them to them in writing. There was no way for us to... Now, later, we could sit down and talk and have this dialogue after we'd both... This was a long, many years later, where we were able to sit down and have a conversation, and I was able to express sincere apology for having written what I wrote. And he was able to say how it made him feel, which wasn't good. So what did it really do? How did I benefit our relationship with that? I only damaged our relationship. But sitting face to face, we could talk about it. We were able to talk through what those issues were and repair that relationship. I didn't go to work for them, but that's not even the point. What was more important to me at that moment was the relationship that I had damaged because of my behavior. And yet, I didn't learn that lesson completely because I had this. I was a territory manager for a manufacturer, and I had this rep that I just felt they had deceived me. And so I carefully wrote out the detailed explanation why I was letting them go. Man, did that cost me pain and suffering in my life. I mean real pain and suffering. Because they went to my boss, my boss's boss, the owner of the company, and complained all the way up that chain. And I got called on the carpet more ways than you can imagine for that letter. Writing something out like that, there's just too many ways to miscommunicate. I could have been 100% accurate. And if I'd sat down with that individual face to face and talked about it, we would have worked through it, and he would have been able to say to me, yes, you're right. I can understand why you feel the way you feel about that, and I can see where you would have understood that we'd made this mistake. Would you give me a second chance or give us a third chance or whatever it is? And then I can say, look, I just feel like we're going to have to go another way. Shake hands and be friends. Call again. But putting it in writing and doing all that kind of thing, it just leads to problems. It leads to miscommunications. Because I wasn't wrong. I was just wrong in how I handled it. And that's part of the problem with how we communicate it. So, John, look, there's a great biblical example of classic miscommunication. And it's found back in the book of Joshua. So, obviously, if we're in the book of Joshua, you know that we're talking about Israel traveling to the promised land. And I'm going to pick up the story here in Joshua chapter 22. Now, before we go there, let's just remind you of the backdrop. So, the tribes of Reuben, Gad, half the tribe of Manasseh had said, hey, we want to stay on the eastern side of the Jordan. This is great land over here. And so the agreement was, that's fine, but your armies will lead the other children of Israel into the promised land to deliver their inheritances to them. They agreed. Before you can settle yours, you're going to take everybody else to theirs. Okay, sounds like a great deal. They agreed to do that. So then on the return from all of that, after that had happened, Joshua chapter 22 and verse 10. Make sure I've got it here. And when they came to the region of the Jordan, which is in the land of Canaan, the children of Reuben, the children of Gad, and half the tribe of Manasseh built an altar there by the Jordan. A great, impressive altar. Now, the children of Israel heard someone say, behold, the children of Reuben, the children of Gad, and half the tribe of Manasseh. There was just no way to shorten that up. Have you noticed that? That's just always the same. It's just, you got to call them what they are, I guess. Built an altar on the frontier of the land of Canaan, in the region of the Jordan, on the children of Israel's side. And when the children of Israel heard of it, the whole congregation of the children of Israel gathered together at Shiloh to go to war against them. So I would say, if you wanted to avoid creating a stir, maybe you should have checked in with somebody before this whole altar thing got started. And yet that didn't happen. This is a game of telephone in some senses, right? Were they doing it because they had wrong intentions with that altar? Were they truly building up a second altar? That was the question. Verse 26. Therefore we said, let us now prepare to build ourselves an altar, not for burnt offering nor for sacrifice, but that it may be a witness between you and us and our generations after us, that we may perform the service of the Lord before him with our burnt offerings, with our sacrifices, and with our peace offerings, that your descendants may not say to our descendants in time to come, you have no part in the Lord. Therefore, we said that it will be when they say this to us, to our generations in time to come, that we may say, here is the replica of the altar of the Lord, which our fathers made, though not for burnt offerings, nor for sacrifices, but it is a witness between you and us. Far be it from us that we should rebel against the Lord and turn from following the Lord this day to build an altar for burnt offerings, for grain offerings, or for sacrifices, besides the altar of the Lord our God, which is before his tabernacle. Now when Phinehas the priest and the rulers of the congregation, the heads of the divisions of Israel who were with him, heard the words that the children of Reuben, the children of Gad, and the children of Manasseh spoke, it pleased them. So it turns out it was just a big miscommunication, because the children of Reuben, the children of Gad, and half the tribe of Manasseh simply didn't say to somebody up front, hey, we're going to be building this for this purpose, and then go build it. They built it and then had to explain themselves later, and they caused difficulty, nearly a war. Communication is an essential part of our lives. But it is in the miscommunications that we can and do unwittingly provoke each other. Can we learn to bear with one another's miscommunications? To patiently endure miscommunications. How else are we different? Really, at the heart of this whole thing, up to now, it's just been exploring differences. Differences we don't choose. Differences that just exist. And it is in those differences where we provoke each other inadvertently, unwittingly, unintentionally. But it can and it does happen. We're different in other ways. Age. We're different in ethnicity. Race. Color. Education. Experience. Culture. We're different in a lot of ways from each other. Some nations, I was reading through all kinds of cultural differences today. And if you've traveled, you'll know that there are some cultural differences. I remember in France, I'm reminded of this because of how fun it was to try to eat breakfast with my left hand today. So in France, apparently, they don't think it's cool if you eat with your fork in the upscooped way. Like, if you're shoveling like this, that's offensive to them. Yet, isn't that pretty much how we eat it with our forks here in the United States? Pretty much everybody eat with their fork like a scoop, because you stab, you scoop, you shovel it on there, and then you get it in there. They think that's the job of a spoon, not a fork. Forks have prongs, so they're stabby things. So use it for stabbing things. If you need scooping things, then scoop with a spoon. So the way that that's handled is they want you to hold your fork with the curvy side, you know, pointing down. And so I'm trying to practice with, and Beck didn't give me a spoon this morning. So I'm trying to eat my eggs and my potatoes with a fork that's upside down, and they're hash browns, so there's lots of little pieces. So I'm trying to stab with this thing in your knife, and then I don't know how these people do it. You got to use a spoon, I guess. I should have asked for a spoon, Becca. I'm sorry. That's just one cultural difference. We have lots of differences between us. That's my point. And cultural is just one of those. But when these differences are all mixed together in a congregation, there will be unintentional and unwitting provocations among brethren. There is such a thing, though, as positive provoking. We can positively provoke each other. It's a very specific definition, a very specific thing. Paul instructed us on that over in the book of Hebrews. Now, so if you look up the word provoke, if you Google or whatever, in your Bible help, you look up the word provoke, you find only one reference positively to this word, and it's found right here. Hebrews 10:24, where Paul literally instructed the Hebrews to provoke one another. 10:24 and 25, where he says, "And let us consider one another to provoke unto love and to good works, not forsaking the assembling of ourselves together, as the manner of some is, or as some do, but exhorting one another, and so much the more as you see the day approaching." You notice how connected these two ideas are of provoking one another and not, what does he say here? And not forsaking the assembling of ourselves together. I mean, it begs the obvious question in my mind. How can you provoke someone that you don't see ever? How can you provoke someone that you never see unto love and to good works? I don't think it's possible, right? You have to see somebody to be able to talk with them. If you were ever going to have a hope of stirring them up, that's what provoke means. Remember, it means to incite. In this way, it's being used in a positive way, to incite to love and to good works. Look, if we were to ask ourselves, if I want to incite you to love and to good works, number one, don't I first have to have a relationship with you? If somebody comes up and wants to offer you some helpful criticisms, and you don't really know them, and they don't really know you, how does that come across? Does that make you want to just roll over like a dog with your belly up? Give me some more. I love that. I want to be corrected more by you. Thank you for that. I don't think any of us are really that way. I mean, if somebody that we know and love pulls us aside and says, hey, brother, I need to tell you something. This has been bothering me, but it's because I love you and because I want to see you improve. I know you want to improve. You say it all the time. I want to get better. And I want to show you something that I don't think you see about yourself. Okay, that conversation is much more tolerable when we are pursuing growing. When somebody loves us does that. Somebody we have a relationship with does that. But if we're not congregating together, how do we form those relationships? And that's why those two ideas are connected so closely. We must be congregating together in order to build relationships. And when we have the relationships, then he says what we need to do is exhort one another. What does exhort mean? It means to call to one's side, call for or summon, to address. I'm going to read you every single one of these because I think in all of these definitions, and there are about nine of them, they flesh this word out much better such that one definition wouldn't quite get it, I don't think. So it says to call to one's side or to summon, to address, speak to, which means to call upon, which may be done in the way of exhortation, to entreaty, comfort, instruction, that sort of thing. It means to admonish. It means to beg, entreat, or beseech. It means to strive to appease in or by entreaty. It means to console, to encourage, and strengthen by consolation, to comfort. It means to receive consolation and to be comforted. It means to encourage, to strengthen, exhorting and comforting and encouraging, to instruct or teach. You begin to get a better sense of what this word exhort means in the positive, all of the positive aspects that we just read, all of those positive things that are so encouraging about what it means to exhort one another. We're familiar with this axiom that's based on a scripture in Proverbs that says what? From Proverbs 27:17, I'll read it to you. As iron sharpens iron, so a man sharpens the countenance of his friend. And key to that is that he is a friend first. You go up to sharpen somebody's iron who ain't no friend. That's not so easy to do. I have pictures of swordplay as opposed to iron sharpening iron. Remember, the iron here that's sharpening is called a steel. It's, if you'll remember, it's a cylindrical metal blade that has a rough edge to it. And so you take that and you run that along the edge of a knife that has been worn down and you lift up the edge that's been curled over by use. And in that process, you remove damaged metal and you smooth that out and you create a sharper edge. It's a very smooth and gentle process. You don't go at that thing whacking at that thing like this. And I think some people think, hey, it's iron sharpening iron. Like, that's helpful. Like, the reason I can come up to you, brother, and tell you whatever, even if I don't have a relationship, is because we're in the church and iron sharpens iron. That's not what that means. So, this is a gentle process. And this process is more effective when we are, and by the way, it requires patience. A good sharpening of a knife requires patience. And that's the sense of it. So we do that with each other in love and patience. We exhort in this environment. We exhort in that way in love and patience with each other. And again, before we can effectively exhort one another, we need to have a relationship with each other. Conflict Well, that's a part of being human. It just is. We do the best we can to mitigate that in life, certainly. And we don't want to have that in the church. But yet, whether it's because of personalities, whether it's because we're too forceful with our opinions, maybe we're miscommunicating a little too often, or maybe we're just plain different, or maybe somebody else is just plain different. We're going to provoke one another from time to time, unintentionally. We have to learn to bear with one another. The key to that, though, that I want to leave us with is a question. Am I bearable? That's an easy question for me to ask because I'm kind of a bull in a china shop from time to time, so I have to ask myself, am I bearable? I mean, we can easily see the idea of bearing somebody else's problems, but what about somebody else bearing with my problems? Am I a bearable person? Am I approachable? Am I correctable? Am I teachable? You know, we know that nobody likes correction. I mean, if you crave correction, I do think something's probably wrong with you. I don't mean correction in the sense of we don't want to get better. I mean the corrective process of somebody can be maybe a little bit, that can be a little messy. And so I don't think we necessarily crave that messy part of that. I think we all crave to improve. But we know that from Proverbs 3, this is another one I know that you know very well, Proverbs 3, 11 and 12. I'll read these to you. My son, do not despise the chastening of the Lord, nor detest his correction. For whom the Lord loves, he corrects, just as a father, the son in whom he delights. It takes great courage for somebody who loves you to come up to you and say, you've got a defect here. You've got a flaw here. Something's a little off here. And I want to help you through that. I want to help you get better here. It takes a lot of love and concern to do that. It's so much easier to just let it go. So we bear with one another when we don't have a relationship. We bear with one another when we have a relationship. But when we have a relationship, we have permission to help someone when they have a problem. That's what the relationship is for. And that's what we should be using it for. The whole point of the days and weeks leading up to the Passover and the days of unleavened bread is that we were to be examining ourselves to see where there might be some leaven that needs to be removed. That's a personal process. That's the am I bearable process. You can't remove the leaven that you can't see. How can you? And that's a part of who we all are. There's just some things we don't see right away about ourselves. And that's where we can help each other. That's where we can show some love. That's where we can exhort one another. If we're going to learn to bear one another, we must learn to be bearable. Am I willing to change? Am I willing to admit that I'm not perfect? Am I willing to admit that I'm fallible? Will I allow my spiritual family to help me see what I cannot see without their help? Will I even ask for help? I think these are important questions for us to ponder as we leave the days of unleavened bread. We are the spiritual body of Christ known as the church, the called out ones. And we're supposed to be drawing closer together, becoming one with one another. And if we are to become one as a body, we need to learn to bear with one another, to patiently endure the differences between us that make us who we are individually, but which can also unwittingly provoke us.